broadband frequency is very difficult. So that
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
That was the nature of Wesley's question number one. Why is the absorbing material in a chamber pyramid shaped? Maybe Wes got some further questions or comments on the subject. N2XJN, K2RIW in the tech band.
Yeah, N2XJN. Very interesting material that you touched. I have a few questions. The TER, you said the speed of light is about 1 nanosecond, but the speed is a factor of time. So I have a problem with the length of the wire because you didn't mention about it.
Yeah, when you're using a time domain reflectometer, and if you're doing something that I called spatial time domain reflectometry, I invented a set of words for what I was doing in that anechoic chamber. I was transmitting very brief RF pulses. Normally when you're using a time domain reflectometer, it makes an extremely sharp rise time video pulse that it puts down the cable and looks for echoes. And that allows you to measure the quality of the connector, the cable, the load that's at the far end, how many perturbations there are along that cable, and so on. But that's a video time domain reflectometer. They never use the word video, but it's really there. But if you're transmitting very, very brief RF pulses into space and looking for echoes, I call that spatial time domain reflectometry. And in free space, that wave travels very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. Every foot of range is a nanosecond of delay of a free space wave. And in the case of coaxial cable, if I build coaxial cable where the dielectric between the semiconductor and the outer conductor is air, and they do build airline, short pieces of it. Airline has a velocity of propagation very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. When you start putting any other kind of, when you start putting any other kind of dielectric material in your coaxial cable between the center conductor and the outer conductor, like for instance polyethylene, and the polyethylene, I forget what the dielectric constant is, but it's something close to 2.5 or 3, and 1 over the square root of that tells you the velocity of propagation. The net result is that polyethylene cable has a velocity of propagation of 66%. Knowing that the cable is 66% velocity factor tells me that 0.66 feet of it is going to have 1 nanosecond of delay, or if I've got 1 foot, I'm going to have something like 1.3 nanoseconds of delay. So once you know the nature of the material that the signal is propagating through, and you know the number of nanoseconds it took for it to come back, putting those two pieces of information together, you can easily figure out what was the length of the particular medium that that signal went through. Back to you, Wes, N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. So, little summary, what I've learned so far. So we have a pyramidal structure, and the length from the base to the tip of the pyramid structure is chosen based on the lowest expected frequency and the absorption required. So what I also got from other sources is that for low frequency dumps, dumping the usual distance from the tip to the base of the pyramid is approximately 24 inches, while the high frequency panels are short about 3 to 4 inches. So panels of RAM, which is the radio absorption material, are installed in tips pointing inward to the chamber, and the pyramidal material attenuates signal, and it does have a 2x effect, scattering and absorption. Now the scattering can occur both coherently and when reflected waves are in phase but directly away from the receiver. Here's what I have a little question. You mentioned about slow transition. Let me jump. So let me increase the power. I want to make sure that I'm getting it right. Okay, 100 watts. Right Now, you mentioned about the slow transition. I have the outboard slotted line, which from one end has a one connector, and from the other one has a conical one, long approximately 7 inches, and it is a transitional. It is not in form of pyramid. It is just like a piece of tube that is slowly getting slimmer and slimmer. I wonder what is so special in ancient pyramid. In why did they choose the pyramidal structure? Back to you.
If this is the best of all worlds, those absorbing cones on the absorbing material would not be a four-sided pyramid. They would be round. They would be conic shaped. That would give you a little bit better absorption from all angles of the signal coming in. But that would be a very expensive process for production. The pyramid-shaped materials, they literally start off with a great big block of foam that's already got the carbon granules mixed into it before the foam was hardened, before it was bubbled up, so to speak. After the foam has hardened, they take a hot wire and draw the hot wire through the foam in a couple of different steps. And you can see that from the edges, a hot wire cutting the foam straight across the foam, and you make a couple of cuts, you end up with these four-sided rectangular pyramids. It's a very inexpensive method of fabrication. But to do it as making individual round cones would require a form. You'd have to be molding it. And now to remove the material from the mold without some of it sticking, particularly the sharp point, would be a real problem. Second of all, those carbon granules probably would settle in a funny way inside of those cones when you're doing the molding. To my knowledge, they do not build absorbing materials with molds. They do it by fabricating as one great big block and then cutting it up with hot wires. Maybe that explains some of why that's the popular technique, even though it's not the best way to do it. It's the least expensive way to do it. Over to you, Wes, K2LIW.
Thanks, Richie. Another technique of making that material is using the ferrite material. So when that material comprises flat plates of ferrite material in the form of flat tiles, fixed to all interior surfaces of the chamber, this type has a smaller effective frequency range than the pyramidal radio absorption material. And it is designed to fix to good conductive surfaces, but I know that the frequency that utilize the ferrite material is somewhere in between 30 megahertz to 1,000 megahertz. Question now, why is that? And to XGM.
If you look at the Skolnick Radar Handbook on the subject of radar cross-section, and in that section they have absorbers, radar absorbers, and if you look at something called Dallenbach screen, D-A-L-L-E-N-B-A-C-K, phonetically, that may not be the exact spelling, but if you have a material that you've made it the right impedance and you make it a quarter wave thick, the material, the signal goes into the material. At the far end of the material, it sees a short circuit and reflects back. But the forward going signal and the reflecting signal meet at the forward surface and give you a cancellation. So the Dallenbach material, properly synthesized, is a perfect absorber, but it's only a perfect absorber at the places where the material is a quarter wave thick. That's part of the reason why it has a narrow frequency region. And I think the magnetic RAM material uses Dallenbach-like characteristics. It's got to be a quarter wave thick at the frequency of design for the velocity of propagation in that particular material. Now back to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Okay, so I understand from that that ferrite plates have a damping curve that makes them more effective between the frequencies from 30, let's say, to 1,000 megahertz, which is approximately the quarter wave. Quarter wave of what? Of 30 megahertz? 1,000 megahertz. Back to you.
Okay, the simple material which has a uniform density, uniform material throughout its thickness, is only good over a rather narrow frequency region where it is a quarter wave thick between the outside world and the short circuit that's on the back end of the material. Now, there are more exotic materials where you have multiple layers of various characteristics, very similar to what I said before, where in the one-dimensional case, I can synthesize 37.5-ohm coax cable by using alternating pieces of 50-ohm and 70-ohm. I said that. No, that's not quite true. I'm trying to go between 25 ohms and 50 ohms. If I was alternating between 25 and 50 ohm pieces of cable, I can synthesize a 37. And I can do that with a variable density between the input end and the output end. I can slowly taper the way I do that. So there are various ways of getting a tapered impedance. And they're very expensive. So these materials that have much greater a bandwidth to their absorptive characteristics, you're going to pay through the nose for them. They're not cheap materials, Wes. Go ahead. K2RIW.
Yeah, Len Green, I believe, is the name of the company who does extremely good chambers. And what I found is that you can buy them on eBay for the price sometimes $5,000, especially if they are small. But if they are big, they go for $400. With all of this foam, everything inside, and all of the cabling electronics, and the filters that goes in between. Just because people cannot fit it through the front door. That's why when I spoke to John, he said, no, no, even though that it's so cheap, I don't want to buy it. Because it was the size of the refrigerator, but it was the much, much, much bigger in horizontal pattern than the fridge and couldn't fit into the door. 50-something inches. Now, question. And to exit. The ferrite and pyramidal shape are the hybrid. Back to you.
I haven't seen a mixture of ferrite and pyramid. Obviously, it's possible. I just don't remember seeing one. And yes, you are right. The depths of the pyramids, the heights of the pyramids, tells you the lowest frequency at which you can use it. And anechoic material that goes down to 1,000 megacycles is very big sets of pyramids. The material that does a good job, I think they're going to be close to 36 inches high. And when you make pyramids out of polyurethane foam, and the pyramids are 36 inches high, and you glue them down to a horizontal wall, it's a very short period of time before those pyramids start sagging on you and the polyurethane starts drying out and turning into a powder. So a chamber made in that way has to be updated every couple of years. It's expensive to establish and expensive to maintain. So good anechoic chambers, not easy. But think about one other thing. The quality of the absorbing material on the walls. You can allow the quality to get lower and lower if the chamber gets bigger and bigger, because the signal coming from your test item that might be in the center of the chamber has to travel through a longer and longer distance before it hits the wall if the chamber is bigger and bigger, and that signal is continuously getting weaker and falling off by the inverse square law. The net result of that, let me drop, was that big chamber out in Edwards Air Force Base is 260 foot square on the floor, 70 foot high on the inside. So the nearest wall to you is going to be 130 some odd feet away when you're standing in the center of the chamber. If the wall was made out of silver-plated steel and had perfect reflection, the signal that propagates from the center of the chamber 133 feet away, hits the wall, bounces, and comes back another 133 feet, that signal is going to be something like 35 dB weaker just because of the free space loss. If the chamber was perfectly reflective on that particular wall that we're testing. And when I first got into that chamber, they were getting echoes that were something like minus 37 dB, and the specification was minus 40. And there was anechoic material on the wall. I knew it wasn't the material on the wall, because if the wall was thoroughly reflective, it wouldn't be that bad. It had to be something that was closer. The stuff that was closer was the pyramids on the floor. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, in the link that I have sent you right below the picture, there is a particular page that is given. You don't have to even go there, but I see the room that was established by Haystack, and that room did have this pyramidal structure on the walls, but didn't have it in the corners. What's so special about the corners?
The only way a signal can get into the corner and get back out of the corner is that it's got to bounce off of a minimum of two walls. So you're getting the absorption of the walls, even though it's not at the most desirable angle, you're getting it twice. So I haven't seen it, but I guess it is possible to not bother putting the anechoic material in the corners. Or if you do put material, it's got to be a different kind. You don't want the pyramids folding through each other in the corners. So you wouldn't continue to use pyramid-like material right up to the corners. A well-designed chamber has different kinds of absorbing material depending on whether you're talking about the center of the wall, the edges of the wall, and so on. They use various kinds of materials in various locations in order to get the best overall performance. Anechoic chambers are a real art and science. For a short period of time, people thought that a conical-shaped chamber was best. They rapidly discovered that was terrible. A rectangular shaped chamber is a hell of a lot better. Over to you, K2LIW.
Interesting. As you know, I'm working mostly with the kilohertz frequencies. So the most favorite frequency range for me is somewhere from 5 kilohertz up to 45 kilohertz. And now, here's the question. How all of this theory applies to the chamber at low frequencies? Or it's simply that the length of the of that low frequency does not apply? And to exchange.
The second set of chambers, so to speak, that I worked at were at the Rome Air Development Center near Rome, New York, near Utica, New York. And what a lot of people have discovered is that building a anechoic chamber at various microwave frequencies is very doable, but there are extremely few chambers in the whole darn United States that have good performance below 1,000 megacycles, below 1 gigahertz. There are very few chambers. When you get below 1 gigahertz, you give up on using a chamber. And you start using what's called a reflective ground plane antenna range. In other words, you accept the fact that you're standing on a flat sheet of ground, you know what the reflections on the ground are going to be, and you design your test in such a way that you use those reflections in a favorable manner. You don't try to avoid the reflections, you use them in a favorable manner. So below 1,000 megacycles, the smart people will use reflective ground plane antenna range, and they don't use an anechoic chamber at all. If you set up your test the right way, all of the signals are striking the ground at a grazing angle, at a very shallow angle, and the phase angle and the amplitude of the reflection that you're going to get is predictable, and you can tune the system for that. Over to US K2RIW.
So this kind of investigation should not be made within the urban structure.
Say that again. I think I missed what you're saying.
The environment of the urban structure, that means the city, when you have buildings, that that environment is not suitable, that's what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, for this kind of scientific investigation.
If you can find a parking lot that's big enough and flat enough, or a schoolyard that's big enough and flat enough, a running track, and you get permission to use it for a period of time, if you can find a flat piece of ground that's big enough, you can do some beautiful antenna testing at VHF and HF frequencies if you're smart enough. And the theory on how to do that is in the ARRL antenna book, but it's hidden in a way that you wouldn't expect to find it. If you go to the chapter on transmission lines and antenna measurements, that's the name of the chapter, transmission lines and antenna measurements. On the back of that chapter is an article written by Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, of Bell Laboratories, and he explains how to set up a reflective ground plane antenna range in a parking lot. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Yeah, I wasn't speedy enough to put it on paper. You can send it to me when you have a time. I would look at... Okay, I believe that the place that I could utilize for that is the... when you're going to Rockways from Queens, there is an abandoned airport. I think this would be a good one.
I agree with you, and the airport is a lot bigger than you need. A good-sized parking lot for most of the frequencies you intend to measure, I think it's going to work. You don't even need a full acre to do it, if you know what I mean. If you go to the ARRL antenna book, any one of the issues in the last 20 years, because Dr. Dick Turin wrote this article for QST magazine way back in 1971, I think it was. But it's reproduced in the ARRL antenna book under the chapter of transmission lines and antenna measurements. In the back of that chapter, you'll see this antenna testing procedure. You'll also see the standard gain antenna for VHF frequencies, which is two dipoles in front of a ground plane. That's on one of the adjacent pages. But the Dr. Dick Turin, W2 India Mike Uniform. Is it W2? Yeah, W2IMU. Dr. Dick Turin. He used to be the guy running the antenna gain competitions at Trenton State College way back in the late 60s and early 70s. Had quite a few conversations with him. Good guy. He's now a silent key. But his article on how to do a reflective ground plane antenna range, which is the beautiful way to make a VHF anechoic chamber in a parking lot. And if you're smart enough, you can get all the accuracy you want out of that. And 2XJN, K2LIW.
So another question that I have in this area is, I don't understand the wavelength dependency. 80 meters is 3.5 megahertz, approximately. Now we're talking about 10 kilohertz, 20 kilohertz, and we're talking about a quarter of wavelength. I mean, it's a huge distance. And you say, oh, okay, a schoolyard is a good one for it. Back to you.
If I'm doing a HF experiment, and I'm all the way down to 80 meters, 3.5 megacycles, where a half wavelength is 132 feet, I really don't have to make an antenna range measurement there, because with rare exception, unless you're a guy that's a millionaire in Japan and you're using the whole top of an apartment building for the ground plane for your five-element rotatable Yagi on 80 meters, except for an antenna like that, you don't have to make an antenna gain measurement. A dipole is so reproducible, you can scale it to a higher frequency to make your measurement and know what it's going to do down at 80 megacycles.
How about 10 kilohertz?
Same thing with 10 kilohertz. You can take a 10 kilohertz thing that you think is an antenna, scale it up to 10 megacycles or 10 gigahertz, just make everything smaller accordingly, make the measurement, and you know exactly how it's going to behave at 10 kilohertz. You can do frequency scaling. Lots of people have done that. Over to you, Wes.
In other words, I'm doing the antenna measurement based on the miniature of this antenna, let's say 1 to 1,000.
You got it. That's exactly right. One of the universal laws of antennas is if you reproduce every single dimension in scale model, diameter of the elements, spacing of the elements, diameter of the boom, and so on. You scale the dimensions of every single element in order to make it operate at a higher frequency. You'll get the exact same pattern, the exact same gain, the exact same front-to-side ratio, the exact same side lobe levels, and so on. So if you're trying to do a very low-frequency measurement and your real estate is not big enough, if you're smart enough, you can scale it to the next higher frequency and do the measurement and know that it's going to behave the same when you go down. Almost always when you do a high-frequency measurement and you scale down to the lower frequency where you really want to use it, usually the accuracy increases, if you know what I mean. OBUS, K2RIW.
Okay, I understand that. I believe, the subject is pretty much explained. Now, question number two. Vector network analyzer, simple way to understand. S11, S21, S12, S22. So what I did, let me just... I have purchased mini circuits coupler, directional coupler, ZDC101. And you see that coupler on the picture. It does have a three port CPL, which is coupling out and in. And then right below you see the picture of my network analyzer from Advantest. And this one does have, if you look at the picture, from starting from the left hand side, output 1, output 2, input R, input A, input B. Now this one was specially made for the filters and the crystal resonators on the production line measurement. Extremely fast. I believe I have seen quite a few network analyzers. This thing is absolutely one of the fastest ones. Now, what I did is, the typical configuration is you connect R, which is the port of the receiver, to the output 2, which is one of the outputs of the generator. As the simple network analyzer is the generator and receiver. Now, you have two other inputs. You have input A and you have input B. So when output 2, one is one from the generator, is connected to input R, input R is then fitted with the reference signal. The output 1 is to be used for something. So let's say I have a filter 21.4 megahertz. So output 1 is connected to one side. Input A is connected to the other side. I'm getting beautiful characteristic of this of this filter. I see bandwidth, everything. Now, the problem that I have had was that I couldn't perform as measurement. I wanted to do S11. I wanted to have one port. So what I did is, I took this coupler, and I connected it this way. So the CPL port of the directional coupler, I connected to output 1. That means to the generator. The out was connected to port A of the receiver, and the in port of the directional coupler was connected to an antenna. And now what? I've got S11. I've got beautifully characteristic of my two antennas. One antenna is the ground plane antenna, which is on 2 meters and 440. And I have seen that my resonance is approximately 147 megahertz, and then I'm getting another one, harmonic one, on 73.5. But then, I say, okay, I see that, I connected G5RV, I was able to see all of the points, that's fine. But then I say, okay, I have S11. That's what I believe I have S11. That's what I'm talking to you and asking you to correct me. But, oh boy, okay, how can I go to S12? Or S to 1. Well, the S to 1, 2 and S to 1 should be just, if I flip the ports, then I have S to 1 or S 1, 2. That's what I believe. But how am I going to do S to 2? So, my question then was, should I understand that S 1, 1 is when I have a directional coupler connected and the input is connected to an antenna, and this is the only way that I can do S11, but then S21 and S12 is always two ports without the coaxial, the directional coupler. Back to you.
I'm going to start off with a definition. You probably know it, but not everybody listening does. A vector network analyzer. A modern-day vector network analyzer that has two ports to it, and some of them only have one port, many of them have two ports, some of them have four ports. We'll go there right now. Let's just talk about a two-port vector network analyzer, modern design, where many of the references and AB connections or whatever are all done internally. And you've got a slightly earlier machine where you have to do all of that connecting externally. The good news is you've got more adaptability. The bad news is you're going to have to work a little bit harder. But let's first define those four S parameters. S stands for scattering. Let me drop. And we know that when we send a signal down a cable and we want it to go to an antenna, we want the antenna to scatter the signal into space. That's one way of looking at scatter. Another way of looking at it, scatter, is I'm sending a signal down a cable. It's going into the input connector of an amplifier. If the amplifier was really good in its design so that it presents a pure 50 ohm input impedance, all the signal coming down that cable into the amplifier would go into the amplifier. None of it would reflect back. But if the amplifier is anything but a 50 ohm input impedance, some amount of signal is going to reflect back. You could call that scattering. So scattering parameters are really measuring how much signal is reflecting or how much signal is being coupled. So let's figure out what these numbers stand for. S11, S21, S12, S22. Those are four numbers. You can set them up into a tic-tac-toe square that's only got four squares to it. And what is S11? You've got S with two subscripts, one followed by one. The first subscript tells you what is the output. The second subscript tells you what is the input when you're doing the test. It's backwards from common sense, but that's the way they did it. So the first subscript is who's the output. The second subscript is who's the input. In the case of S11, obviously the first connector on your device on the test is port number one, and you're using it as the input port and as the output port. That's a fancy way of saying you're measuring the reflective power from the first port. You're measuring standing wave ratio. When you rate standing wave ratio as reflection coefficient in decibels, that's one way of measuring S11 if you want to represent it in decibels.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
But if you're going to use any of the S parameters inside of an equation, and there's various equations where these numbers become very handy, know that those S parameters for the equation has to be a real number, not decibels, and it's numbers of voltage. So it's a voltage. S11 is input voltage reflection coefficient. If my signal that I put into my unknown device is 1 volt, and if half a volt reflects back toward me, that's an S11 of 0.5. 0.5, take 20 times the log of that, it's minus 6.02 dB. So a reflection coefficient of S11 equal to 0.5, I can also re-represent it as a reflection coefficient of minus 6 dB, and I could also rate it as a standing wave ratio of 3 to 1. 1 plus S over 1 minus S is one of the definitions of a standing wave ratio. So 0.5 reflection coefficient is a 3 to 1 standing wave ratio. It's a minus 6.02 dB S11 reflection coefficient, or it's a 0.5 reflection coefficient. So that's what S11 is. S21 means that since the first subscript is 2, I'm going to take the output from the second port of my device on the test. Assume my device on the test is an amplifier. It's got an input connector and an output connector. The input connector, I'm going to call it port number 1. The output connector, I'm going to port number 2 of my amplifier, my little black box on the test. So S21 means that I'm going to take the output from the second port. The 2-1 means I'm putting the signal into the input port. So S21 sounds backwards. That is forward, gain,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
S21 is forward voltage gain characteristic.
Yeah, but that occurs also only with two ports. So if I have a real antenna, then I have to have a generator from one side. That's a simple way of network analyzer. And from the other side, which antenna I cannot connect, I should have a receiver.
Yeah, I'm going to first tell you what happens with an amplifier, which is the simple case, then I'm going to tell you how you measure S21 of an antenna. And I do that every day. I've got this little black box called amplifier. It's got port number 1, port number 2. I'm putting the signal into port number 1. I'm taking the signal out of port number 2. And believe it or not, that is called S21.
Yeah, that's tertiary transmission line.
S21 is forward voltage characteristic. If my amplifier had a voltage gain of 2, where I put in 1 volt and I get out of 2 volts, that would be an S21 of 2.0. I could say it's got a positive 2.0 dB of voltage gain. S21 is equal to 2.0. And positive means that it doesn't have a phase inversion. It might have minus 2.1 because the output signal is out of phase with the input. And I could also talk about the phase angle. All of these parameters have a voltage characteristic and a phase angle. They can be represented on a polar chart or on a Smith chart. Polar chart is the easiest way. So S21 is forward voltage gain. An amplifier with 6 dB of gain could have twice the output voltage versus the input voltage. And if it's positive 2.0, that means it has no phase shift. If now I want to measure the S21 of an antenna, I'm really measuring its gain. In order to measure the signal coming out of an antenna, the second port is not there on the antenna in test. You have to create the second port. The way you do that is you take a standard gain antenna that you put in front of your antenna under test at a known distance. If you know the gain of your test antenna, if you know the gain of your sampling antenna, the second antenna, I'm going to call it the sampling antenna, he's going to take a sample of the signal that you have launched into space by the antenna you're testing. Your first antenna is the antenna you're testing. You've already measured its S11. That means you know its standing wave ratio. Let me drop. And now you want to sample how strong is the signal that it is launching into space. That's its gain. If I now use something like a reference horn, something that I know the gain of for the second antenna, and I put that in space at a known distance, and it better be in the far field range, not the near field range, otherwise you've got to do some more mathematical correction. If I know the number of feet between the first antenna and the second antenna, and I know the amount of free space loss that comes from that number of feet of free space, and I know the gain of the second antenna, once I measure the S21 on the network analyzer is going to say the signal coming out of the second antenna is 25 dB weaker than the signal that you put into the first antenna. Well, that's a good piece of information. If free space loss was 15 dB, and if the antenna that's doing the sampling has got 5 dB of gain to it, I now know that the signal that I measured is minus 20, and by the mathematics, I can easily figure out what is the gain of the antenna that I'm testing. So you have to establish a second antenna of known gain at a known distance in order to measure S21, which really is the gain of the antenna under test. Does that make some sense, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW.
N2XJN. Yeah, it makes perfect sense, but I don't see the distinction between S21 and S12. This is only reversing the port.
Yeah, in the case of the microwave antenna range that I have set up in the office that I normally go to during the day, I usually transmit using the antenna that I'm tweaking, that I'm testing. I usually receive with another standard gain antenna a known distance away. I could, if I want to, reverse the two positions. I could reverse the cables, reverse the positions, whatever. However, in the case of an antenna, that would be an almost useless test. You could do it in order to confirm that the instrumentation is being reasonable, but the law of reciprocity of an antenna says that whatever gain and pattern and front-to-back ratio and front-to-side ratio and side-load levels, whatever an antenna does on transmit, it must do the exact same thing on reception if it is a truly passive antenna. If it doesn't contain any circulators, doesn't contain any amplifiers, it must obey the law of reciprocity. Therefore, the S21 and the S12 of an antenna must be the same. Since it must be the same, unless I just want to confirm my instrumentation, it is a useless test to measure S12 when I just measured S21 and 2XJN, K2LIW.
Yeah, early in the week I spoke to Glenn, and then we spoke about S22, and I got completely confused.
KC2, QIQ with a question.
Okay, let me answer that one first, and I'm going to go right over to you, Glenn. In the case of a two-port black box that I call amplifier, where the input connector is port number one, and the output connector is port number two, to measure S11, I'm measuring the input standing wave ratio of that amplifier, to put it in ham radio terms. To measure S22, I'm measuring the output standing wave ratio of that amplifier. In the case of an amplifier that's made by the balanced amplifier technique, which means there's really a pair of amplifiers in there, with a quadrature hybrid on the input end and a second quadrature hybrid on the output end, and if I hook them up correctly, and if those two amplifiers are as bad as they can be as far as input and output standing wave ratio is concerned, but because the two amplifiers, as bad as they are a matched pair, and if I've got a good quadrature hybrid on the input and a good quadrature hybrid on the output of those two amplifiers, I will measure 50 ohms input impedance, I will measure 50 ohms output impedance, even though the basic amplifiers might each have an input standing wave ratio of 5 to 1 and an output standing wave ratio of 10 to 1. That's the magic of the balanced amplifier and two quadrature hybrids. So in that particular case, measuring S11 tells me how good is my hybrid and the marrying of my two amplifiers. Measuring S22 is telling me how good is my output hybrid and the marriage of the output impedance of those two amplifiers. So S22 on a two-port device has a lot of meaning. If I'm measuring a real tetrode tube amplifier, let me drop it. A tetrode tube amplifier is a nearly constant current generator. The input impedance is a function of how well I've tapped up on the input coil and resonated the input grid and so on. I could have, at a particular power level, a very good standing wave ratio on the grid, the input connector of that tetrode tube amplifier. But no matter what the heck I do, the output standing wave ratio of that amplifier is going to be terrible. The S22 is going to be very close to unity. In other words, whatever signal I send back into the amplifier in reverse is going to come re-reflecting to me. The pentode tube amplifier, even though I properly adjust the tuning and loading circuit on the output, because it is a nearly constant current generator, it is an almost open circuit on its output. The S22 is going to be terrible. To measure it is going to scare you, and there's no good reason to be scared. That's just the way a pentode tube is. Output impedance is terrible. It works beautifully when you connect it to an antenna. It'll create a kilowatt of power, but its impedance is far from 50 ohms. It gives the best performance when it's loaded at 50 ohms. It gives you the least amount of total harmonic distortion, intermodulation distortion, when it's loaded with 50 ohms, but its impedance is nowhere near 50 ohms. It's probably 5,000 ohms. Over to you, Glenn, KQLIW.
Good evening, Dick. Actually, my question is with reference to the first discussion, where you have a test antenna on a range and an antenna that's under test and a reference antenna, and you're making your measurements in the far field on an antenna range. And my question is, in that particular case, how many wavelengths would you normally set up the antenna, the separation between those two antennas to in wavelengths, would you place them to be in the far field? KC2QIQ.
That's sort of like saying, the lady that I'm about to marry, should she be 5'2", 5'5", 5'7", 5'11", or 6 feet? How tall should the lady that I marry be? You can tell there is no fixed answer. There's a lot more variables involved. In the case of the near field range of an antenna, there is no fixed number of wavelengths. That's the far field. Until you tell me the gain of the antenna. The far field, the usual definition, and this is a slightly fuzzy definition, the usual definition of far field is 2d squared over lambda. D is the effective diameter of the capture area of the antenna, that's D, diameter, 2 times the diameter squared divided by wavelength. You give me a high gain antenna, by definition, it's got a large capture area. Its D is a big number. So the high gain antenna, you must be much further away from it. Do it in feet, do it in wavelengths, doesn't matter. You're going to be much further away from a high gain antenna. A very low gain antenna, like a dipole, you can be probably a half wave away from the damn thing and not be disturbing it. So the distance from the antenna is a function of the gain of the antenna. I've given you the classic formula definition, 2d squared over lambda. You can rearrange all of those numbers and reproduce the number of gain of antenna versus number of feet you must be away from it to be in its far field. If that makes some sense, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
It does. But it really doesn't answer my question. I guess the question I'm asking you for is some practical experience. Typically, if you had like a rule of thumb that you probably use to kind of take a guesstimate of in wavelengths versus gain, let's say, for an antenna to get a reasonable measurement.
Okay. I was doing the measurement at 915 megacycles. I was measuring a 9 decibel gain antenna. I had to be a minimum of 3 feet away from it, and the wavelength is 12.9 inches. So a 8 or 9 decibel over isotropic antenna, you must be 3 wavelengths away from it to be in its far field. Is that specific enough?
Yeah, no, that's very good, Dick. So in other words, if you were, let's just say, working with antennas, and most of the antennas that I've worked with aren't Yagis. They're mainly like, 5/8 wave verticals, that sort of thing. I've been using a number like somewhere around five wavelengths and, kind of like open field measurements. And it seems to have worked so far, but I'm wondering if there's a downside to being too far away. KC2QIQ.
As far as far field effects are concerned, being too far away, absolutely no problem. But yes, there is another phenomenon. As you make the range longer and longer, the free space loss between the antenna under test and the sampling antenna is going to be a longer distance. The free space loss becomes a bigger number. By definition, you're listening to a weaker and weaker signal. Depending on how strong is your signal generator and how sensitive is your receiver, that can give you some grief. Second of all, as you make the antenna range longer, you now usually have more stuff in the environment that's going to give you a significant reflection. If I can make a range 3 feet long, and my range on my two desks happens to be 3 feet above the floor, and I've got anechoic material on the floor, I've got a pretty good range. If I now stretch that range, instead of 3 feet, I made it 30 feet. All of a sudden, I'm still three feet above the floor on the antenna under test, 3 feet above the floor on the antenna that's doing the sampling, but I made the range 30 feet long. I'm now going to get a super weak signal. I may have signal-to-noise ratio problems in the receiver, and I've got 30 feet of floor between those two, and the signal is hitting that floor at a very shallow grazing angle. I'm getting a whopper of a signal off that floor and off the walls on the side and off the file cabinets that are in between and the other desks and all the other stuff that's in the room, because it's not really an anechoic chamber. This is an anechoic chamber that's good to the nearest half a dB, if you know what I mean, the way I use it, maybe a quarter dB on a good day, particularly when I use the right kind of reference antennas and a substitution test. But you make the range longer, and you run into the grief of weak signal, more reflections, and you better have a pile of anechoic material that's really good at a grazing angle. Those are tough requirements. KCQQIQ, KQLIW.
That's pretty much what I've experienced. And so you've actually had good performance around three wavelengths. I got to look, you know, try actually doing some of these a little bit closer and do that. But thanks to the ESPIC, that's some very, very useful information with testing and measuring antennas. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
QA2SAY with a question.
Doug recognized, but before we go over to Doug, I'm going to give you one other piece of information as to what is the origin of 2D squared over lambda. Because depending on what book you go to, somebody else will use 3 or 4D squared over lambda to be more conservative. The 2D squared over lambda is based on the assumption that the sampling antenna is doing the transmitting. It in reality can do the receiving, but because of reciprocity, that doesn't matter. Assume the sampling antenna is doing the transmitting. And when you're in the far field of an antenna, the antenna looks like it's a point source radiator, or very close to it. In reality, it's a horn that's a foot wide and three-quarters of a foot high, but let's assume now it appears to be a point source when you're far enough away from it. The point source, by definition, if it really was a point source, is putting out a spherical wavefront. As you get further and further away, that spherical wavefront becomes flatter and flatter. When you're in the 2D squared over lambda range, the D is the diameter of the effective capture area of the antenna you are testing, and you know by geometry the rate at which the spherical wavefront is becoming flat. The bottom line is, let me drop, because the spherical wavefront is hitting that spherical, is hearing that circular effective capture area of your antenna under test, which you assume is flat. It's got a no curvature feel to it. You make that assumption, and the spherical wavefront is hitting it. How bad is that? At exactly 2D squared over lambda, the edges of your circle of effective capture area are seeing a phase error of 22.5 degrees compared to the center. The center of your spherical, of your circular aperture, your effective capture area of your antenna under test, is getting the leading edge of that spherical wavefront is hitting the center of that circle. The edge of the circle, because of the spherical wavefront, is getting a signal delayed by 22.5 degrees. That amount of curvature of field of the exciting signal to the antenna under test gives you a predictable amount of decrease in its gain, which I think is something like a quarter of a dB. And I can work out the mathematics of that. But in other words, you're something like a quarter of a dB, or maybe it's an eighth of a dB, in error, pessimistically, because you're lighting it up with a spherical wavefront instead of a completely planar wavefront. If the signal doing the emitting was at an infinity in distance, that phase front hitting your antenna on the test would be a planar wavefront. You see that picture, Glenn? KCQQIQ first, K2LIW.
I sure do, Dick. And it's really, really fascinating stuff. One of these days, I'm actually planning on working on a small 1296 Yagi that I'd like to build for my station here, because I don't really have a lot of good antennas in that area. So I definitely want to brush up a little bit more on my antenna range experience over here, and I'm sure you're going to hear more questions from me in the future. Back to you, Dick, and thanks again.
Yeah, Dick, before you go to another question, I don't see a distinction between S22 and S11 in terms of the antenna.
There is no difference. Oh, S22, a single antenna with one input port does not have an S22. There's only one port there. It has an S11. It doesn't have an S22. Well, let me go over to Doug. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Glenn. Doug.
This is W-A-2-S-A-Y. All right, I have a question for you. And it, obviously there's an easy cure for it, but the actual question is this. Suppose I have two antennas, each of which has, let's say, what you use 9 dB gain, all right, each of which has 9 dB gain, and you say you have to be three wavelengths away from one antenna to get out of the near field. Now I'm going to use these antennas pointing at each other and make a measurement. Do I have to be six wavelengths between the antennas or only three?
Oh, you're going to love this one, Doug. It's going to drive you crazy. The answer is none of the above. The magic of what we're about to talk about. You and I ran into this with our 3 foot diameter dish antennas on 10 gigs. If I'm testing a 3 foot diameter dish antenna on 10 gigs, the calculated near field range, as I vaguely remember, was something like 92 feet. You've got to be 92 feet away from that 3 foot diameter dish because the dish, by definition, 3 feet is 36 inches and the wavelength is 1 inch, so it's a 36 wavelength diameter antenna. And you've got to be a zillion wavelengths away from that to be in its far field. And it comes out to be something like 92 feet. And you could make a measurement at 92 feet, and you'd figure out the gain of your 3 foot dish antenna. Then you could, that's where you're now picking it up with a small sampling horn. And now you decide to make the gain measurement where a pair of 3 foot diameter dish antennas are aimed directly at each other. How far do you have to be? And the answer is, you could be 3-4 feet away. Not 92 feet times 2. How come? By definition, the parabolic reflector that is 36 wavelengths in diameter is a beautiful collimator. It is not, in the real world, a point source. It is a planar emitter. That phase front coming out of that parabolic reflector is very close to a planar wavefront. And when that planar wavefront from the first dish hits the second dish 3 feet away, it also is set up to listen to a planar wavefront. And that's what it's getting. You are now, what you're doing is a telescope measurement where you've got two collimators looking at each other. You make that measurement.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
You make that measurement with 2 3-foot dishes aimed at each other 3 feet apart. And you measure the insertion loss between the two dishes. Ordinarily, the free space loss at 10 gigs for 3 feet, I don't know what the exact number is, but it's probably 40 dB. There's probably 40 decibels of loss at 10 gigahertz in a 3-foot range. That's free space loss. And you aim these two dishes at each other, and you put 0 dBm into the first dish, and you're going to get minus 0.5 dBm out of the second dish. You're going to get half a dB of loss between the two. And you say, what in the world is going on? Each dish has got 35 dB of gain. I've got them looking at each other. I've got 40 dB of free space loss between the two. I put a signal into the first dish, and I'm going to measure a signal coming out of the second dish. That's half a dB down. You're way inside the near field ranges. You've got two collimated antennas, and these two collimated antennas are issuing and listening to planar wavefronts. It's a beautiful impedance match. That's a beautiful example of what's called beam waveguide. Until you stretch those two dishes 10 feet away from each other, you'll see very little fall off in the signal strength versus distance, because you have created beam waveguide. Now you know why a periscope antenna is such a potent antenna system. W-A-2-S-A-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, well, that makes sense, but it doesn't answer the question. Forget about dish antennas. Suppose I have two three-element Yagis or something like that. In real life, which is probably what most people are going to have, two three-element Yagis or maybe five-element Yagis or something like that, what then do you do about the measurement? Go ahead.
What I've done day after day and got beautiful results for years after years now, I've been doing it for quite a few years, I'm testing three-element Yagis very frequently. my sampling antenna happens to be a three-element Yagi, and I'm setting them three wavelengths apart.